Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking with the folks from Wild Earth Guardians about steel leg traps and wildlife. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Tony McCarty. He is Executive Director of Kitchen Angels. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
So there are so many organizations we've had on. I don't think I've ever had Kitchen Angels on the show. And it's a group that does amazing work in Santa Fe. Tell us about what you do.
Well, we prepare and deliver meals to people who are living with chronic or terminal illnesses or going through some sort of emergency situation. We deliver meals to people who have no other consistent support system, you know, family, friends, who could make meals and bring them over to them. So that's our purpose, is to just provide nutrition so that people can do the things they need to do to heal and hopefully get back into society. And if not, you know, let them be comfortable in the safety and privacy of their own homes as long as possible.
Nutrition is a big part of it. It's not just providing meals, but it's providing meals that actually are part of the healing process, which, as we know, is not going on necessarily even in hospitals at times.
Well, I hope it is going in most hospitals, but I will tell you that we have 6 dietary tracks that we plug people into. And the idea is to get the correct food for them so that they can first eat it, so that they want to eat, make it appetizing enough that they're really attracted to eat, to maintain their weight. So we have 3 diet tracks. We do a regular diet for people who, you know, just need a heart-healthy diet with low in trans and saturated fats, low in sodium. We have a gastrointestinal diet for people who may be going through kidney dialysis or some sort of specialty diet or with extreme allergies, food allergies.
Right.
And then we accommodate vegetarians. And on either of those tracks, you can overlay a gluten-free option, which is a huge dietary consideration all across the country these days.
And these are things that people, even who aren't recovering or healing from illnesses, are trying to deal with all the time, is, you know, gluten-free and organic and healthy, heart-healthy and intestinal tract-healthy.
Exactly what everybody should be considering in their diet. You know, we all cheat, but, you know, the main thing is to get food that will help heal your body and keep you strong enough to do the things that you need to do every day.
So where does the food come from?
We have to purchase most of our food, but about a quarter of our food comes from the local food bank. We actually share a facility with the Food Depot and a third agency, Food for Santa Fe, which is a once-a-week pantry program. And we do the home-delivered meals. The idea of coming together with these groups was to attract better quality and larger quantity donations, and also a place that people would know that they could come, and if we can't provide the correct service for them, we can certainly send them in the right direction. So as for Kitchen Angels, folks can just call in to see if they qualify. It's very easy. It's 471-7780 is our telephone number. We do a short survey with folks that call in. The criteria is very simple. It's people who are usually under 60 years old. They have no other means to provide meals for themselves, and they're homebound. You know, they only leave their homes for doctor's visits, assisted outings, things of that nature. People are always shocked when you say under 60 years old. Well, there are 2 reasons. We accept seniors onto the program that have special dietary considerations that our Meals on Wheels program doesn't provide for, because Santa Fe does have a meal service especially for seniors. And so most of the seniors go through that program.
And a lot of people, for example, who have had accidents or illnesses do qualify. And I imagine you get a lot of people who have moved here from elsewhere and their families are not here.
Exactly. You know, 97% of our client base is below poverty level, the federal guidelines for that. But we do occasionally get people who go through major surgeries and are alone in town without a support system. And those are the folks who can qualify for our program.
There is a quotation on your website that says that the cost of feeding one individual for an entire year is equal to the cost of one day in the hospital.
Isn't that amazing?
That's crazy.
It's unbelievably crazy. So one of our claims to fame, I will say, we do a client survey every year, and we ask them questions like, have you visited the emergency room this past year? Have you stayed in the hospital overnight? One of the things that they say to us is because they have Kitchen Angels meal service, they are able to afford their medications. They stay out of emergency rooms. And that was 17% of our clients told us that they did not have an emergency room or hospital stay in the past year, which is enormous. I mean, when you consider the cost to everybody for folks who are on the indigent program at the hospital, you know, that's something that we all pay for. So if we, Kitchen Angels, and all of our volunteers who help us, can keep people healthy enough to stay at home, that's one of the big goals that we strive for.
Part of it is also, I mean, I don't know how much of this there really is, but not only is food showing up, but a human being, in fact an angel, Kitchen Angel, is bringing that food. Is there much contact between the people who deliver and the recipients themselves?
We encourage people to visit. What we ask of our volunteers is one shift, one day a week. So it's a manageable amount of time. Most people can work in the 2 to 3 hour commitment that it takes. And absolutely, we encourage people to visit. Let me read you from a letter that one of our clients has sent us. It says, "Dear Kitchen Angels, all of you, when I was bedridden, sleepless, and in near constant pain and fatigue, to know that caring people were making me delicious, healthy meals and bringing them to me, caring to do that, brought such relief. Nutritionally, yes, but more than that, it is so lonely being ill. To see the bright smiles and to get to chat and come to know the angels that deliver the meals truly helped me get through some long and difficult days. Sometimes these were the only contacts I had with anyone."
Amazing.
So that's it in a nutshell. You know,
yeah.
Our volunteers do bring in the mail, take out the trash, do small errands. And in the most extraordinary case I've heard, one of our volunteers drove a client to Denver for some tests for a transplant that he needed. He drove him to Denver, put him up in a hotel, made sure he got to his appointments, and drove him home. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. our volunteers usually
it's
don't.
It's not in your agreement.
No, usually you hand in chat for a bit, you know, to find out how people are doing. And that's the important part, because at the visit, when you deliver to somebody every Monday, you figure out their habits and their schedules, and you know when something's going wrong. You know if they're not answering the door, something's up. And, you know, there have been situations where we come upon folks that have one of the other most extreme cases. We found one of our clients with multiple sclerosis. She was living with MS, and she had fallen in her bathtub. And that was on a Friday night, and she was in the bathtub over the weekend because she couldn't get out.
Oh, Lord.
And so one of our delivery drivers on Monday knew her habits, knew that she never left her home. So he was able to call 911, get the paramedics over, and, you know, she was fine.
Saved her life.
Yeah, basically saved her life.
Extraordinary.
I hate to be dramatic, but that's what happens.
Every
day, you know, I like to say that the angels save people's lives every day. Just be, you know, preventing isolation, you know, letting them know that they are a part of a larger community, that there's somebody that cares for them.
Tony McCarty is executive director of Kitchen Angels. So, and I think what you're saying underlines the important part of healing and also the late in life, end of life stuff that we've talked about with people about hospice and things like that, but that it's not just getting your physical needs met, that part of healing is knowing that somebody cares about you.
The University, I think, of Minnesota did a study a few years back, and it was about how to, it was about quality of life and how people age better. And there were three things that they came up with. It was consistent nutrition. It was having someone visit them every day. And the third one was for the person to be interested in something. And I think when you have the first two taken care of, you're more likely to be interested in life.
Right, exactly. And you can see why people who are, I know, for example, a person who is the matriarch of an extended family with 8 children, 25 grandchildren, a bunch of great-grandchildren, and is never alone,
yeah.
And is a very happy person despite multiple chronic pains and all sorts of things.
Yeah, when you have the basic needs met, you know, some place to live, something to eat, you can be interested in more things when your mind is engaged.
So your volunteers sign up, and their job is basically to, one day a week, deliver a number of meals to people in, Santa Fe County, Santa Fe City?
It's the greater Santa Fe area.
Okay.
The majority of our clients live in Santa Fe, and our drivers take usually about 8 people. You know, some of the routes grow really rapidly, and they get up to 10, but we like to split those routes as soon as possible so that people can spend time, not only deliver the food, but to visit with them a little bit. I can tell you a story about a personal story about a delivery that I made once.
When
a few years after I had started working, one of our drivers called in, and she was unable to deliver her route, so I said I would take it to her. And it was a very small route then, and 3 of the deliveries were in a not-so-good neighborhood for Santa Fe. So it was, you know, I had a little bit of apprehension about going over there, but, you know, the folks needed the food. I knew that, so I made the deliveries. First 2 went fine. The 3rd delivery I came to, the door cracked open just a little bit, and his hand came out. And he grabbed the bag from me of food, and then, you know, it pulls back into the door. The door starts closing, and even before I had said a chance to say hello or anything. And so I said, "Hi, how are you doing today?" just before the door closed. And the door stopped. You know, it came back open, this big toothy grin on this kid's face, you know. And he just said, "You mean you want to talk to me? Usually people just hand me the bag and go away." So I said, "Sure, I'd love to come in for a second." And so I don't remember a lot about the conversation we had that day, but I do remember that he had a fountain in the middle of his efficiency apartment. It was a studio apartment. And he made a big deal about wanting to turn it on for me because I was a guest in his house, and he was very proud of it. And so that moment crystallized the importance of Kitchen Angels for me. Me spending 5 minutes with someone who hadn't seen anybody all day, it made a big difference for him. And it was, you know, just 5 minutes out of my life. So since then, I know that a simple act of kindness can change an afternoon for one of our clients.
When somebody says, "Okay, I need Kitchen Angels, I'm going to give them a call," so, and they qualify, they're under 60, they're homebound, so on, what happens next?
Well, we do a survey and we ask, you know, how they get to their doctor's appointments, how do they get their food now, you know, is there any family in town? In addition to anybody being able to call in, we get referrals from, you know, the hospitals in town, doctor's offices, professional home health care agencies, neighbors who may be on service that know of somebody. After we go through the survey and people seem to qualify, we follow that up with a home visit, and that's when we tell them what to expect from Kitchen Angels while they're on service and what we expect from them. And that's basically to follow the rules and let us know when they're no longer homebound. At that time, we give them a doctor referral form, and the doctor confirms for us their condition, how long they may need our services. And that's it. It's a pretty simple process, and we can usually get people signed up within 2-3 days.
Now, how do you find your volunteers, and who are your volunteers?
Our volunteers come from everywhere around the city. You know, we have some volunteers who have been with Kitchen Angels for the full 19 years of our history. It's still a handful of people, but the dedication is unbelievable. About, oh, I would say 75% of our volunteers are long-term volunteers, and by that I mean 5 and more years around. The folks that come in and out of the program, I don't think really find the job that they have an affinity for best. You know, they just go away before they can figure that out.
Right.
One of the best places we got volunteers was the Santa Fe Block Party. And unfortunately, it wasn't happening this year.
Oh.
So it's like, uh-oh, we have our summertime, which is the time of biggest need because our regular volunteers go on vacation It's a time of transition when people move, kids are out of school, so they, you know, they're doing, you know, basic life things for themselves. So they, summertime is the time when we're always looking for cooks and we're always looking for delivery volunteers. And it's easy to do. Just give us a call. Again, the number is 471-7780. And you'll want to talk to Cheryl. She's our volunteer coordinator. And she finds out when you have time available and when we need someone in a shift. And we try to plug those two times together. It usually works out pretty well.
Do people who volunteer for the cooking, do they have to have cooking experience?
Not at all. You know, we have every level of volunteering available, from washing dishes to, you know, basically being the assistant to our chef. So, you know, chopping, making salads, getting ready for the afternoon, packaging food. We have, you know, a heat seal system, so everything has to be put through this press. So that's not a greatly, there is finesse to it, but it's not a greatly skilled job.
Right. And so then we they go in these bags and they go out for delivery every day.
Well, yeah, we have two shifts of cooking from 10 o'clock until noon. And then we have the 1 o'clock shift until 3:30 or 4 when everything gets individually packaged, finished up. It goes then into our delivery room. We have people called delivery driver coordinators. And they're at the kitchen from 3:30 to 5:30 when everything gets packaged. And they're the folks who take all those specialized meals and make sure they get to the right person, be the right driver. Our drivers come in between 4:30 and 5:15, and they pick up a route of 8 to 10 people. And then they have those delivered by 6:30. And that's the program Monday to Friday. We send out the three-course fresh meal. People get either a soup or a salad, an entree with vegetables, dessert or fruit. They can have both if they want. Three times a week, we send out whole grain breads. Once a week, we send out a bag of whole fresh fruit so they have nutritious snacks around the home. And if they need additional calories in their diet, we have protein shakes available.
Nice.
And I forgot the weekend. Of course, on Thursdays and Fridays, we send out entrees so that people can have them available for the weekend food.
So they can put stuff in the refrigerator and have it available over
Correct.
The weekend. Now, you're doing some classes that anybody in the community can take. It's organic meals on a budget.
Yeah, that's a collaboration with Slow Food Santa Fe and the Santa Fe Farmers Market Institute and Kitchen Angels. And we are attempting to address what's going on in industrial agriculture and the food system and, you know, that we're all facing. So our idea is to provide recipes and techniques to use local fresh produce. Not always organic, but, you know, I think the key is local, knowing where your food comes from and how it was grown.
Right.
So what we're trying to do is give simple menus to folks and the techniques to use it so that they can feed their family well and affordably. And those classes are on Wednesday and Saturdays of the first week of every month. And so we have some coming up really soon in August.
Yeah, August 3rd and August 6th, Wednesday and Saturday, and then September, October, basically all through the year, 12 months out of the year.
Correct. And you can sign up online. That's the most direct way to do it. And it's localorganicmeals.com.
localorganicmeals.com.
Yeah, there you
also
go.
Once again, the Kitchen Angels telephone number is 471-7780, and you are looking for volunteers at all levels, especially the, as you said, the driving and the cooking.
Yep, exactly. Those are the two basic areas that we always need people to fill.
You have another program called Adventures a la Carte. What's that all about?
Yeah, we're in the third year of this program, and it's basically things that regular folks don't normally have access to. People have shared their uniquely New Mexican experiences with Kitchen Angels for us to raise some funds. We've done some remarkable things this year, including a wonderful day in La Madera with Felipe Ortega, who is one of the very well-known Macacius potters. We are going twice this year to Star Axis. And if you don't know what Star Axis is, Google Star Axis New Mexico, and you will see an 11-story pyramid in Anton Chico that is aligned with celestial events.
And oh my goodness.
I know. It's incredible. And it was so popular that we added a second Star Axis. The one on the website is sold out, but we have added one on the 17th of September. You'll have to call the office to get into that one. And we have another wonderful thing coming up in October at Pueblo San Lazaro, which is the largest of the pueblos that were in the Galisteo Basin. And the owner is walking us through and the excavation and telling us about what they've done and how the people lived during that time frame. So those are the two that we have left that you could participate with. It's a really fun day. And everything with Kitchen Angels has good food involved. So.
And this is a fundraiser for Kitchen Angels. Once again, kitchenangels.org.
Yeah, kitchenangels.org, and you'll see the sign up on the homepage.
And Tony Bacardi is Executive Director of Kitchen Angels. They're also on the web at kitchenangels.org. Anything else you want to add before we go?
Oh, could I finish up with a client letter?
Yes.
Okay. Dear Kitchen Angels, I've been writing this note to you in my mind over and over. No matter how many ways I have come up with to express how grateful I am to you and what you mean to me, still there is only one word that truly describes it well enough, and that word is miracle. I really didn't know that I was almost starving till I began eating. I know that sounds odd. People have commented for a long time on my weight and appearance, and I saw it, but had given up seeing it for what it really was a long time ago. My weight won't likely change all that much due to the chronic health challenges that I have. However, I look less like I am wasting away now. I had been taught how to eat healthy when I first became sick, but the impossibility of doing the shopping, preparing it, and the expenses just erased most of the recommended formula from becoming a reality. I realized that I had just lost interest in food over time, eating the same few things that I could manage over and over. They probably get tired of my saying thank you, but there simply is no way not to let them know how grateful I truly am each time that eagerly anticipated meal arrives like some sort of miracle, magically nourishing me after so many years of not even being able to imagine eating this way. Now I know firsthand how you came by your name. You are truly angels.
Tony Bacardi, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Wendy Kiefover and Kat Cannon. They're both from Wild Earth Guardians, and they're here to talk about the trap ban on public lands and the consequences for wildlife, for New Mexicans. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Good to have you both. So let's talk, first of all, what is this trap ban? What kind of traps are we talking about? How did they get banned, and what is the status of the trap ban right now?
Well, we requested that the Game Commission in 2009 open up what's called the fur bearer regulations, and so those are the animals that are trapped because they have commercial value for their pelts. And then we asked in June that the commission consider a public lands trap ban. And then last year, we got Governor Richardson, he put into place a trap ban on the Blue Range of the Mexican Wolf Recovery Area for a six-month period. And the Game and Fish was to do a study to see if trapping indeed harmed Mexican wolves. And as of Thursday, the Game Commission made a ruling on this issue, and they determined to lift the trap ban in the Blue Range Mexican Wolf Recovery Area. They also opened up trapping to even a larger extent than it had been before we had made our request.
So was the study done to determine the effects of trapping on public lands?
Yeah, the study was the Game and Fish commissioned the New Mexico State University Wildlife Cooperative Unit to investigate that study, and it was completed, and they've made it They've withheld it pending it getting published in a peer-reviewed journal. So the study was never made public, and yet the Game Commission made a ruling to open up trapping anyway.
There was an editorial and a number of articles that have been written in the various newspapers about this as raising some real questions about open government decisions that affect New Mexicans, both human and animal, I suppose you could say, are being made that are not, studies are done and being paid for the public, but are not being disclosed to the public.
Right, exactly. Not only was that study not made available, but we found evidence that Game and Fish was colluding with the trapping industry and the livestock industry over this rulemaking process, and we went to their offices to look at those records. We sent some volunteers, and it looks like a lot of the records that we were looking for were withheld, and so we think that Game and Fish is in collusion with the trapping industry and the livestock industry. And therefore, we got this really terrible result from the Game Commission last Thursday.
There were a lot of petitions that were circulating about this that went, I guess, to the New Mexico Department of Fish and Game. It was a big, I guess it wasn't a big impact, but it was a large number of people who signed those. Is that correct?
It was, we reckon it's between 7,000 and 10,000 people, if not more, and Kat can speak to that.
Right. So apparently we have between 7,000 and 10,000 signatures, and I know that at the Game Commission hearing yesterday, about 23 trappers spoke in favor of trapping, and I'm pretty sure that their total amount of letters sent to the Game Commission was fewer than 400. So it seems that they're really not acting in the public interest, because if that were the case, they would be making a decision that reflected the opinion of 65% of New Mexicans rather than 2,000 trappers.
So let's help me walk through this whole chain of, I guess you would call it, bureaucracies. Now there's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, there's the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, there's the Game Commission, there's the research unit that did the study. Wendy, can you place for us can you give us an understanding of who all these players are and how they interact?
Yeah, absolutely. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, their purview is to protect endangered species, and the Mexican wolf being one of those. In fact, the Mexican wolves are probably the most endangered species on the planet, or one of the most endangered species on the planet in the wild. There's less than 60 individuals roaming, you know, on the Gila and Apache Sitgreaves National Forests. And then the state wildlife management agency, that's the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, and they make regulations pertaining to wildlife that are not on the endangered species list. And then ruling Game and Fish Department is what is called the Game Commission, and that body is appointed by the governor, and it sits at the behest of the governor. And so it's a very political body, and so we get very politicized decisions.
The Game Commission, I guess, was recently appointed by Governor Martinez, is that correct?
Yes.
And who's on it? I mean, what types of people are on it?
It's a very narrow interest group representing a lot of livestock growers and sportsmen, so
and
the hunters and anglers. But it does not represent the broad public. It's not a democratic institution.
If you actually look at their biographies on the website, only two of them really have background in wildlife management or wildlife science, and most of them are avid hunters and anglers, and several are members of the NRA, and one of them is actually on the board of directors for the Cattle Growers Association. And if you go to that website, there's a banner on their main page that says, "Speak now or forever keep your trap shut." And then they go on to urge their members to send letters to the game commissioners in favor of allowing traps on public lands. And Scott Beidegan, who is a game commissioner, is on the board of directors for the Cattle Growers Association. So that just kind of gives you an idea of how narrow the backgrounds are.
Now, the Cattle Growers Association is in favor of trapping, not because they're trying to catch valuable fur-pelted animals, but because they don't like wolves. Am I understanding that correctly?
Right. They basically don't like wildlife, period. It doesn't matter if it's elk or deer or coyotes or whatever. They always view themselves pitted against wildlife. We just did an investigation involving wolves in the Northern Rockies, and we looked at the kill to livestock reported by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and compared those data with data derived by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually ground-truthed the livestock kills. That is, they went out and they verified the kills, whereas the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they just rely on livestock growers to tell them what the kill, you know, how many livestock have died. Nevertheless, even in the Northern Rockies, of the total inventory of cattle, less than 2% died from wolves. And nationwide, of the total number of cattle and sheep grown in the U.S., less than 1%, one half of 1% have died from native carnivores and domestic dogs. So it's absolutely a minuscule number of cattle and sheep that get killed by native carnivores and domestic dogs. Far more important are weather, disease, birthing problems, and things like that to livestock growers. But yet they still have this just unbelievable ire against wildlife, and it's completely misplaced, and it's not based on any reason or rationale.
When you talk about native carnivores and domestic dogs, those are two very different groups. I mean, are livestock being killed by sheepdogs and things like that?
It's probably feral dogs. So when we look at cattle and sheep data, the carnivore most likely to kill sheep or cattle are coyotes, and then secondarily, it's domestic dogs. So it's probably not sheepdogs, it's probably just feral dogs that pack up and kill.
And so then when you take that one half of 1% and it includes all of these carnivores, wolves are an even more minuscule part of that.
They're at the bottom of the list. They're absolutely at the bottom of the list. They're not an important, I mean, in terms of numbers, they're not an important livestock predator in terms of the overall numbers. And that is, you know, and that might be because of, you know, they're not wide ranging. I mean, they've been killed back to less than 5% of their historic range. There's only wild wolves really in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. There's a few dispersing to Oregon and Washington, and then we have basically a handful of wolves in New Mexico and Arizona.
Is there restitution for cattle growers who do have their livestock killed by carnivores?
Yes. Some states pay compensation, and I think those compensation programs are completely wrong because what it does is it institutes, you know, more subsidies and it institutes fraud. So what I think should happen is livestock growers should not get compensated. They should use non-lethal alternatives to protect their livestock. So, you know, keeping cattle and sheep in pens at night, using lambing and calving sheds, electric fencing, there's a whole host of things that they can use to protect their livestock. There's, you know, this is one industry that gets so many subsidies, and predator control is one of the many. They get, you know, the USDA Wildlife Services spends, you know, $126 million a year killing our wildlife, largely for livestock interests. And we just did the numbers on that. Kat and I put together the numbers. There was a 112,000 or 114, I don't remember the number off the top of my head. But so they go up an aerial gun and they poison and they trap and they shoot and they kill pups in the den. They do all sorts of horrible things for the livestock industry, and yet the numbers don't bear out this huge waste of resources and the enormous amount of killing that goes on, and especially when we're talking about wolves and mountain lions and grizzly bears and things like that. I mean, these species are very rare on the landscape, and it's really sad.
We're talking to Wendy Kiefover and Kat Cannon from Wild Earth Guardians.
So I think also what people don't realize is that wolves play a really essential role in maintaining the health of ecosystems. I mean, they prey on animals that are unfit, which helps keep populations healthy, and they also prevent large herbivores like elk and deer from becoming overpopulated, and that helps maintain biodiversity. I mean, we've seen that when deer and elk become too abundant, they overgraze, and then they destroy much of the plant base, and then that makes habitat less suitable for other species. And when we reintroduce the wolves to Yellowstone, the concentration of elk herds was reduced, and so the damage that they were doing to meadows and wetlands by over-browsing was reduced as well, and that actually improved vegetation around streams and increased biodiversity in those areas for birds and fish and beavers and other species. And then you have people who are worried about coyotes killing their livestock. Well, wolves also help to reduce coyote populations. And that happened in Yellowstone as well. When they introduced wolves, coyote populations were reduced by as much as 50% in some areas. And that helped the populations of pronghorn and red fox come back. And so I think there's just this huge lack of understanding about how integral wolves really are in the entire ecosystem.
It's such an important and interesting point, is that when you remove one species, it has an effect on so many other species in ways that are often really counterintuitive.
Right, exactly. Right. And then, you know, bringing it back to the New Mexico trapping situation, we know that 23,000 bobcats have been trapped in New Mexico over the last decade. And the reason we know that is under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, bobcat pelts have to be tagged. What we don't know is how many swift foxes, kit foxes, gray foxes, and all sorts of species who are trapped for their fur have been killed. So what we're seeing in New Mexico, and I think it's only going to get worse with this decision on Thursday, is we're going to see even more trapping, even across broader landscapes, and it's really a shame. And so one of the things that we're going to do, we boycotted the Game Commission hearing because it was absolutely a kangaroo court. It is a body appointed by Susana Martinez, a body that is absolutely hostile to wildlife. So we're going to hold our own hearing. We're going to hold a public hearing on the trapping issue, and we're going to have it in Albuquerque on September 14th, I think at the main library, and we're calling it Trapping on Trial. We're going to have our own citizen panel that actually is a broad array of New Mexicans that's going to sit and listen to New Mexican citizens and listen to the issue of trapping with fortitude and not just from the industry point of view.
What are some of the rules around trapping? In other words, if I go ahead and go on the internet and buy myself a steel leg trap and go up to the Santa Fe National Forest, can I just put it down and come and see what I get, you know, a few weeks later?
I'll let Kat answer. Go ahead.
Okay, so right now trappers pay $20 for a trapping license, and after that there are no bag limits, so they can kill as many animals as they want. And I think the setback limit now for trails is still 25 yards, but they increased it to half a mile for dwellings, boat ramps, and campgrounds. And they are required to check their traps every day, and to have an identification number on their traps, but they definitely do not comply with those rules all the time. And so at the end of the trapping season, they're supposed to submit a report to the Department of Game and Fish, which sort of summarizes the animals that they've taken. And their only penalty for not complying with that is an $8 late fee. And after they've paid that, their trapping license is renewed. So the regulations are just so lenient. We've seen a lot of a huge drop in compliance. I mean, a few years ago, I think it was up to 79%, and last year it was down to 29%.
Compliance with the rules.
Yeah, compliance right. with these reporting at the end of the year. You have to report how many animals you killed. And the other thing that's going on is with the trapping regulations, they only have to put the traps 25 yards from a trail that is designated on a federal map, so like a Forest Service map or a Bureau of Land Management map. But if it's a social trail, which there's thousands of miles of those in New Mexico, just people going out and going on hiking trails, there's no setback distance at all. And so we've seen a huge uptick in the number of dogs and even cats getting caught in these traps. And we're getting calls all the time from folks who have had negative trap experiences involving pets. There was a woman in Taos, around Taos, who's two dogs got caught, and in the process of releasing the first dog, her own hand got trapped in a leg hold trap, and she was unable to open that trap, and she had her hand stuck in the trap for a half an hour, and she suffered numbness and problems with her hand for several weeks afterwards, and she incurred, you know, hundreds of dollars in not only medical expenses for herself, but in veterinary medical expenses, which the trappers don't have to pay for. And oftentimes the trappers, if there's a dog in a trap, they'll kill it rather than, you know, risk letting it loose. And so it's just, you know, it absolutely affects everyone. So if you recreate in New Mexico, trapping should be something that you consider. You know, if you have search and rescue dogs, if you have hunting dogs, it's, you know, that danger is out there looming, and there's no notification to people that traps are in the area.
I think that the number of people who have had dogs caught in traps or who have encountered dogs caught in traps is a lot higher than what we might expect. I was recently tabling at a rock climbing gym, and over 2 days I had several people tell me that either their dogs were caught in a trap or they'd come across a dog in a trap and had no idea how long it had been there. And just the process of releasing a dog, I mean, it's already in so much pain. It's a terrifying situation, and then a lot of times the dog will just run away. And I think because so many people don't know sort of the severity of this trapping issue, they don't report that to anybody because they might just think that it's a freak incident. So I think there are even more cases of that happening out there than we can imagine.
There's another argument that this is, and this is one of the kind of New Mexico is open for business arguments, that if you allow trapping, that's a part of the economy and that it'll be good for the economy if more people are out trapping animals that they can sell the pelts of. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are only approximately 2,000 trappers in the state of New Mexico, and I know that the amount of revenue the state gets from people who are wildlife watchers is somewhere between $200 and $300 million a year. So to me, that argument really just reflects Governor Martinez's interest. I mean, she has said that that she's worried because of ranching families and loss of their livelihoods. But I think that in this case, she needs to take a stand that reflects science and public interest.
Yeah, and the economics of wildlife watching tourism, which is enormous.
Right.
You know, it's clearly enormous in New Mexico. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does these periodic surveys of wildlife recreation, and by far, far more people spend money doing wildlife recreation. That includes all the hospitality, gasoline, you know, buying bird seed, everything that you can imagine. It's something like, I don't remember, I think it's like $40 billion a year in America. And we know that wolf-watching tourism in Idaho, New Mexico, and Wyoming is $36 million a year. It's a huge amount of money. And so the fact that they're saying, you know, that a handful of people are going to benefit from you know, trapping animals and selling their fur, yeah, that might be the case. And especially in the case of bobcats, there's been an uptick in the price of their pelts. Some pelts may reach $600 a piece if it's a super high quality pelt. And so what we've seen is this macabre rush on wildlife in New Mexico and you know, a handful of greedy people trapping out the state's wildlife against the public interest of the rest of the people who would like to witness those wildlife, you know, in the wild.
And not only the people who want to witness them, but there are also, as you were alluding to before, some real benefits to ecosystems of having a balanced ecosystem with wild, you know, a lot of these wildlife species in it.
Yeah, and, you know, if you're a farmer or a rancher, the last thing you want are a lot of rodents, you know, overrunning your crops or even competing with livestock, right? So having these carnivores in the ecosystem can actually benefit the livestock growers if they were so mindful to think of it in those terms.
We're talking to Wendy Kiefover and Kat Cannon from Wild Earth Guardians. There's another aspect of the whole trapping issue that has to do with just the simple cruelty of catching an animal, a sentient being. These wolves are seriously conscious, beautiful animals. In a leg trap, the way they are trapped, the way they die, or a bobcat or any other animal.
Right. So oftentimes these animals will actually remain in the traps for days, despite the fact that trappers are required to check their traps every day. And when these animals are immobilized, I mean, they can experience dehydration, hunger, self-mutilation, and predation. And if they do escape from the trap, they definitely have a reduced ability to survive. And a lot of these traps definitely don't strike on the intended body part. And a lot of them don't render the animals unconscious in the recommended time. So Born Free USA is an organization that recently did an undercover investigation on trapping in the United States. And they have videos from several of the different states which captures different trappers and their killing methods. And it's just absolutely horrific. And, I mean, to me, the animal cruelty side of this is enough of an argument for why trapping shouldn't be allowed on public lands at all.
We've got just a minute left. Wendy, you want to tell us the details about this trapping trial event in September?
Yeah. Mary Charlotte, we're going to be hosting an event. It's called Trapping on Trial, September 14th at the Main Library in Albuquerque. And I believe we're going to start around 2 in the afternoon and go till about 7 p.m. And we have a citizen panel that consists of a federal court judge. We have an attorney. We have a hunter. We have a wildlife advocate. There's a whole host of people from all different walks of life that actually represent the broad base of New Mexicans, and we are going to hold a public hearing in a large place so that the public can attend this hearing and to learn more about trapping rather than what the Game Commission did, and that was to hold a hearing in Clayton, New Mexico, and made it off limits to the public on purpose and as a result muzzled the public, gagged the public. And so we want to turn things around and make the public aware about the dangers of trapping, the cruelty of trapping, and the host of dogs and endangered species and even wildlife that are not considered endangered, such as bobcats and swift foxes, and look at the plight that happens to them, so in a very public forum.
Wendy Kiefover and Kat Cannon are with Wild Earth Guardians. They are on the web at wildearthguardians.org. Thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.